From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. A number of big decisions from the Supreme Court today. One ruling that finds nearly half of Oklahoma is an Indian reservation. We'll talk about that in a moment. On the issue of President Trump's financial records, the court ruled 7-2 that the president is not categorically immune from records requests from a New York grand jury. The president called that decision not fair.
And in the case of a request from Congress for the president's records, the justices had concerns it was too broad. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, though, said that both rulings show the president isn't above the law, and they seem to show that at least a grand jury in New York can see the president's financial documents, but that nothing will be revealed to the public before the election. NPR National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson is here. And Carrie, start with the case from New York. The opinion says no citizen, not even the president, is categorically above the common duty to produce evidence when called upon in a criminal proceeding. Tell us more about that decision and what happens now there.
Yeah, Chief Justice John Roberts wrote for the court majority. He was joined by the court's four liberals and two justices appointed by President Trump, Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh, although they may have disagreed with some of the reasoning. The bottom line is that the president is not above the law when it comes to a state criminal investigation and a subpoena for records. In this case, the Manhattan District Attorney's Office and a grand jury there had subpoenaed one of President Trump's accounting firms seeking 8 or 10 years of financial records from the president based on his personal conduct before he ever went into the White House as part of an investigation that they had launched after Michael Cohen, President Trump's former personal lawyer, had testified that he paid hush money to try to keep a couple of women quiet during the 2016 campaign. We now know, based on the majority opinion from Chief Justice John Roberts, that based on 200 years of precedent in the Supreme Court, that presidents have uniformly agreed to testify and provide information when called in criminal proceedings. The president, though, according to the majority, can still challenge subpoenas in the lower courts as bad faith or burdensome or overbroad. Basically, the bottom line conclusion by John Roberts was there's a public interest in fair and effective law enforcement that cuts in favor of comprehensive access to evidence.
Yeah, well, in fact, they robbed him of the one defense he did feel he had, which was immunity. They said, you don't. The second case involves the House request for records, also 7-2 ruling. Explain that decision and where that goes.
This one was a little more complicated, Robin. This was based on subpoenas from three different House committees to the president's accounting firm and two financial institutions that held some Trump records, again, based on private conduct, not involving the presidency or the actions in the White House. And in this case, Chief Justice John Roberts said that lower courts had failed to consider properly the separation of powers and the balance of powers and the tug of war between Congress and the president. So the court majority here, same one, basically ruled that the lower courts will have to review this case again and think about a number of factors like does Congress really need this stuff? Is there any other way to get this material? And that Congress will really have to show it needs this information. Both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, counted this as a partial victory. In the short term, though, Robin, it means that because this is all going back to lower courts, it could be a long time, if ever, before the House committees get these materials, certainly not before the November elections. That's for sure.
Right. But to be clear, especially in the New York case, is there thinking that the grand jury in New York will get access to these financial records since, again, the president's one defense was that as president he was immune?
It seems likely the grand jury under the holding by the Supreme Court majority will get access to tax returns and other records. But as you know, Robin, grand jury materials are secret. It's against the law to leak those things. So I don't know when, if ever, they will become public. But it seems in the medium term that the grand jury will get those materials for sure.
And just quickly, Chief Justice Roberts wrote both opinions. We've been hearing he was trying to corral as close to a unanimous vote as he could get. 7-2, pretty good with this court?
7-2 is not bad, but remember in the case involving President Clinton and the earlier case involving Richard Nixon, former President Richard Nixon, the Supreme Court was 9-0. In this case, the chief just could not get Sam Alito and Clarence Thomas to sign on to the majorities.
Okay, NPR National Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. We'll be hearing about these court decisions all day, I'm sure. Carrie, thank you.
My pleasure.
Well, today the Supreme Court also ruled that nearly half of eastern Oklahoma is legally a Muscogee Creek reservation for the purposes of federal law. In a 5-4 decision, Judge Gorsuch sided with the court's liberal wing in favor of honoring land treaties that were never dissolved by Congress. For more on that and what this means, we're joined on Skype from Tahlequah, Oklahoma, by Rebecca Nagel, host of the Crooked podcast, This Land, which examined the origins of this case. She's also a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. Rebecca, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, and there are a lot of implications of this decision. First of all, tell us about some of them and what this means.
Yeah, so the court ruled that Congress created a reservation for Muscogee Creek Nation through multiple treaties throughout history and also never disestablished that reservation. There's some language in Gorsuch's opinion that is pretty strong for Native rights, that basically, you know, there are a lot of times that courts in the past have ruled that if it's inconvenient for a state or for the government to follow a treaty, that can be reason enough. And Gorsuch and the justices that joined him soundly rejected that idea. And so Muscogee Creek Nation is the fifth largest tribe in the United States. It has a reservation of about 3 million acres in northeastern Oklahoma. But there are four other tribes that have a very similar, almost parallel history to Muscogee Creek Nation. And the implication is that because the court upheld Muscogee Creek Nation's reservation, those four other reservations are upheld as well. And that includes the reservations of Cherokee Nation, the Choctaws, the Chickasaws, and the Seminoles.
And when it comes to the things that I guess some people would consider inconvenient about this, what does this mean for people who had been tried in the past in this part of eastern Oklahoma? Does this throw their convictions in some cases into question?
Not very many. That was one of Oklahoma's main arguments. You know, they had a whole host of arguments that basically the sky would fall down and it would be the end of life in Oklahoma as we know it. And I think in the coming months, we're going to see that those arguments never held any water. The truth is that it's actually really, really hard to appeal a conviction once you've been convicted. So, you know, think about states that have legalized marijuana, but still have hundreds of people in jail for possessing pot. Like, just because this law has changed, a lot of people who are currently imprisoned, who are Native people who committed crimes on one of these reservations, time has actually just run out for them to file what's called a federal habeas petition. So there will be a handful of cases of past convictions where people will have the grounds to appeal, but most of them won't. And I actually did, with the help of a paralegal, that research. You know, we looked at a sample of 300 of these past convictions, and we found that less than 10% were eligible for an appeal. Mm-hmm.
Now, this was a complicated case that started with a murder. Just give us a little history of this Supreme Court case.
So in 1999, a Creek citizen named Patrick Murphy killed another Creek citizen named George Jacobs, and he was sentenced to death. But in his appeal of that death penalty, he argued that Oklahoma did not have the jurisdiction to convict him of that crime because his crime occurred on a reservation. And in the summer of 2017, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals agreed, and they affirmed that the reservation of Muscogee Creek Nation was never taken away by Congress. And that case went to the Supreme Court. We were all, you know, this time last year waiting for the decision. And then the Supreme Court didn't make one. And then they postponed it. And then this year they granted cert to a second case, Jim C. McGirt, who, you know, committed different crimes, but basically appealed his case on the same grounds that it happened on a reservation. And so that's the sort of winding story of how, you know, a small town murder in eastern Oklahoma in 1999 turned into one of the most important Supreme Court decisions for indigenous land and treaty rights in the United States.
Now, in addition to following this case as a journalist, you're also, as we said, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation. What does this decision today mean for you personally?
I get emotional thinking about it. You know, I the first thing I did once the decision was up, I just went to see who wrote it. And when I saw it was Gorsuch, I just started sobbing. You know, we as our original homeland is not actually Oklahoma. We were removed here. And when we traveled the Trail of Tears, we were promised that this land would be ours as long as the waters ran and the grass grew. And for over a century, Oklahoma and the United States government has not kept that promise. And today, the Supreme Court did.
That is Rebecca Nagel, who is a citizen of the Cherokee Nation and host of the Crooked podcast, This Land, joining us on clearly a momentous day for Native Americans and for this country. Rebecca, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
COVID-19 cases are surging in Florida. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention report the state has seen more new cases in the past 7 days than any other state, including Arizona and California, where cases are also surging. Joining us now is Matthew Petty, Assistant News Director at WMFE in Orlando and host of WMFE's Intersection. Matthew, what is happening across the state at this point when it comes to the number of cases?
Yeah, well, Florida is really emerging as one of the worst hotspots for this point in the pandemic. We had nearly 9,000 new cases of Florida residents reported yesterday, according to the Florida Department of Health. 120 new deaths reported as well. That death toll is now over 4,000. And that 120 figure, that's the highest daily death toll to date. So some significance to that number too. I mean, basically, the numbers just keep climbing, as you mentioned. We've added a lot of new cases in the last few days, few weeks, and the total case count is more than 232,000 cases since the start of the pandemic statewide, which is just a big number, and that keeps climbing.
And are stores and restaurants starting to shut down again as those cases climb across the state?
Well, it's kind of depends on where you are. I mean, it's a bit of a case-by-case basis in some parts of the state. South Florida, for example, some of those stores were restaurants were ordered closed again. Some restaurants in Central Florida, at least, are voluntarily closed because of isolated cases. And of course, we've been reading and seeing about bars being ordered closed in recent weeks as cases have spiked up. Of course, here in the Orlando area, we're sort of anticipating the reopening of Disney World. A couple of the parks there opening, the Magic Kingdom and the Animal Kingdom are opening to the public again on Saturday. They've sort of been having this soft reopening throughout the week to annual pass holders and others. And, you know, Disney says it's got those precautions in place to reopen safely, but reopening is kind of proceeding, and it's basically businesses are voluntarily closing if they feel they need to, but that's the extent of it to this point.
Well, and just briefly, we're hearing about hospitals where ICU beds are already full in Florida.
Yeah, that's an interesting stat. I mean, some hospital ICUs are hitting capacity, but hospitals do say they have capacity to expand. One thing that reporters have been asking the governor and the State Department of Health for is hospitalization data, and so far that data has not been forthcoming. Just here in Orlando, though, I can tell you that Advent Health, one of the hospital systems here, had a press conference this morning and confirmed they're now in phase two of their emergency because of COVID-19. And that means that the hospital system is kind of moving staff around and they're anticipating a surge in hospitalized patients. So the hospitals are sort of making plans to accommodate the onslaught of patients to come.
Matthew Petty at WMFE in Orlando, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, like everyone else, members of Generation Z are dealing with how their futures are going to change as a result of the pandemic. Yesterday, we spoke with three young people about that and the protests. Shaquavia Strawn, 20 years old, a student at Spelman College in Atlanta. Gael Fernandez, 17, who was in Anaheim, California. And Adam Morris, 19 years old, a student at Notre Dame University. Here's the rest of our conversation. Let me ask you about politics, because this is an election year, even though it will probably be a very unusual election year because of the pandemic. Are each of you eager to vote this year in the election? And is your vote up in the air? Or do you know who you're voting for? Gael, I'll start with you.
Well, sadly, I can't vote yet. But yes, I am quite eager to vote. If I were to vote, sadly, I think I would have to vote for Biden. You know, I don't support either of them, but I think having Trump in office for four more years would be extremely destructive and divisive to the country. I think it would be the wrong choice for the country. And, you know, the common argument was Biden isn't much different and won't bring about much change. And I think that's just a very privileged way of thinking, because a lot of people that say that is simply because they're not personally affected by the changes that Trump has made. I mean, if we keep Trump in office for another 4 years, DACA might completely end. He might try to end that again, which he said he will do and he wants to do. So thinking about that is, and saying that, you know, I'd rather not vote at all, it would basically means that you don't actually care that much because it's not personally affecting you, which is why I think that's who I would vote for.
But you're 17, so you can't vote this November yet. Adam Morris, what about you? You're 19. You are going to be eligible to vote. Will you vote, and who will you vote for?
Yes, this will be, you know, obviously my first either presidential or a midterm election. I'll be supporting President Trump, as you know, as a conservative and, you know, vice president of College Republicans. I, you know, support many of his policies, and I think recent events have shown, you know, some of the dangers that will happen if Biden gets elected, especially on issues of criminal justice. In cities all across the country, you see Biden, if you look at his campaign platform, he will substantially weaken the criminal justice system at a federal level, which will, you know, which is really the last backstop when the state criminal justice systems seem to be coming apart as they are right now.
Let me just ask you one question about that, because we talked about the coronavirus pandemic, and a lot of people on both sides of the aisle have criticized President Trump for not wearing a mask in public. With your own concerns about COVID and how careful you've been, are you upset with the president who you're going to support for not taking it seriously enough to wear a mask in public?
I do not oppose his decision to do that. It's not because I'm opposed to mask wearing generally, but I also do not believe mask wearing as sort of a universal practice. There are definitely situations where it is important, but as, you know, the president, you know, I want to be able to see him, you know, first of all, see his face and see strength and, you know, emitting, you know, coming out of his figure. And a lot of people have accused him of not taking this pandemic seriously or not responding quickly enough, when in reality, he has, you know, spent, you know, trillions in terms of funding, you know, the stay-at-home orders and allowing people to stay at home away from the pandemic. So I think a lot of the criticism is certainly misguided, and simply the fact that he is not wearing a mask frequently is not something that I would blame him for doing.
Shaquavia Strawn, you're 20. You will be voting in November, will you? And who will you vote for?
First, I agree with Gael about his sentiments about the elections and how it will be destructive to have Trump in office for 4 more years, seeing as the things that have transpired. I also believe that Biden is kind of neck and neck with Trump as far as a candidate, as far as a human being. So I'm not 100% supportive of Biden. However, I know that 4 more years will be very destructive. I also believe that when you're voting for a president, when you're voting in a system that actively does suppress a lot of voters, there is issues that will arise. So I will vote in the 2020 election, and I will vote for Biden. However, I do not agree with his past policies and incentives that have hurt Black communities.
I want to finally just ask each of you, because one of the things that we've heard about Generation Z is that you are facing a lot more mental health issues, depression, et cetera, than previous generations. How would each of you rate your mental health right now? Or has this particular, you know, the pandemic, which has been hard on everybody, has it been hard on you, especially hard on you? Adam, I'll start with you.
Initially, it was, you know, disturbing just because I had some symptoms that of illness, and I thought I might have had the virus, and I was, you know, worried that I might spread it to my parents. But as I, you know, as I improved, as I got better and also learned more about the virus, I became less anxious generally, although being at home, you know, away from people for a long time and not interacting with people outside of the home too much has been difficult. Although, you know, I do, you know, like doing things like reading and, you know, music and things that I can do by myself. So it hasn't impacted me too much.
Gael?
Well, I think when this whole thing first started, I was definitely fine because I try not to worry too much about it and just, you know, keep a level head towards the whole situation and just take time to process everything. Now more than ever, I'm definitely feeling the impacts of quarantine and the social isolation and, you know, lack of contact with people. That's definitely led to, you know, some feelings of loneliness that I've been experiencing more now. So that has definitely, you know, took a hit on my mental health. So it's definitely affected it. But yeah, not doing too bad, I would say.
And what about you, Shaquavia?
I can understand the feelings that arise from quarantine and social distancing. That is not something that is ideal. However, me and my community of friends and family have been doing a great job of keeping each other in good spirits, trying to be adaptable and do Zoom calls, Zoom dates, Netflix parties, just trying to maneuver through this space and try to learn this new normal that we're living in.
Well, thank you all so much for joining us and being so open and honest about your thoughts. It's very interesting to hear from a younger generation about all these things, and we should do it very often. Shaquavia Strawn, 20-year-old at Spelman College in Atlanta, Gael Fernandez, 17-year-old from Anaheim, California, and Adam Morris, 19-year-old at Notre Dame University. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
India reported nearly 25,000 new coronavirus infections today, and its transmission rate is rising for the first time since March. The health ministry says the country's death toll is now more than 21,000, and India has 767,000 infections, the third highest total in the world. The BBC's Nitin Srivastav joins us from Delhi on Skype. Nitin, the explanation for these numbers, especially this increased transmission rate and 25,000 new infections in one day, is that because of an easing of restrictions?
Well, yes, we can say that. But the other most important aspect of the rising number of cases is a clear-cut example that the testing is happening much more than it was happening 3, 4, 5 weeks before. So we know that India is such a huge country with a big population. The more you test, the more there is a probability of discovering infections. And that is something which is happening in India. And the fact also remains that there were many Indian states with huge population who were not testing as frequently as some other smaller states. So the numbers are definitely going up. Of course, the numbers are alarming. And that is also the reason why the central government, the federal government, has asked all states in India to ensure that 80% of the new COVID-19 cases that are being detected now are traced and quarantined within the next 72 hours of confirmation.
And you say the more you test, the more you find the cases, but also the more you test and find the cases, the more you can contact trace. And then the more you test, you find that the rates have gone down. That's hopefully the goal. So is the contact tracing happening so that people can be quarantined?
Yes, that's what the government is trying to do. Experts feel that there have been instances where there have been localized community transmissions, and that is more worrying because when localized community transmissions happen, and now that India is actually been in an unlocked state for the last 1 month or so, there is always a chance of the transmission happening not just in that particular area, but in a far off region, because now the borders within India are not closed. And that is something which should be really worrying the government. Of course, there is a flip side to it. There's a different aspect to it. The other thing is that if India has more than 700,000 confirmed cases, out of that, more than 450,000 cases, people who got infected have actually recovered as per the government data. So that leaves India with almost 250,000 active cases. Now, that is something which the government says is a good thing, something to cheer about. But yes, of course, as you said, the 24,000 cases in 24 hours is surely worrying.
Yeah. And just briefly, Nitin, what does it look like there from your point of view? I mean, is everyone wearing masks? Is everyone social distancing?
Well, yes, there's a lot of talk about social distancing. There's a lot of talk about governments, federal government and the local governments fining people for not wearing masks and following social distancing in public areas. But, you know, it's a 50-50 kind of a situation. There are places, there are areas where people are really particular about maintaining social distancing and wearing masks. But there are areas where people are absolutely not bothered about social distancing. That's also a fact.
Well, same here. So the BBC's Nitin Srivastav in Delhi. Thank you so much.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
So it's so interesting that it turns out that microwaves can zap the coronavirus. Oh, wait, that's not true. But the Pope did tell me that the world would end this month because of the virus. It was a private conversation. Oh, no, that never happened. But I did have a talk with Mother Nature while she was eating peaches from a peach tree. No, these are all COVID dreams. We've talked before here about COVID dreams. Jeremy spoke with UC Berkeley's Matthew Walker back in April. We'll link you at hereandnow.org. These phantasmagoric, vivid dreams people have been having. Harvard dream researcher Deirdre Barrett says the combination of a global crisis and stay-at-home orders, more time to sleep, makes this an extraordinary time in the history of dreaming. She asked online for people's dreams, and she got an earful, thousands of them. And now she's published a collection in the new book, Pandemic Dreams, along with serious advice on practical exercises you can do to control your dreams. And Deirdre Barrett joins us now. Welcome.
Hi, nice to be here.
As you divide these into categories, a lot of people dream of catching the virus. Talk about that.
Yes, either literally catching the virus, I can't breathe, I'm spiking a fever, I must have the virus in a dream, or a little bit dreamlike. One woman looked down and saw blue stripes on her stomach and faux remembered that that was the first symptom of COVID-19 infection. But also then these wild metaphors about the virus. Bug attacks have been a really common cluster of metaphors for the virus, I think partly because we use the slang term, I'm getting a bug, to mean I'm getting a virus.
And people are not only dreaming of getting it, but dreaming of getting away from it. Here's one. Humans were attempting to leave our planet, boarding any ship they could, tiny houseboats to gigantic cruise ships. We were floating in a giant convoy, picking up new passengers. This idea of getting away from.
Yes. They have these visions of going somewhere, different society. There's one of the kind of post-apocalyptic where the North Pole is the only place that the virus can't be. So this woman is trekking around on the tundra and she's got a gun, which she says in real life she's never owned. And a polar bear attacks her and she shoots it. Parenthetically says she would, she'd never shoot anything, much less an endangered species. But she's in this kind of brutal Mad Max plus ice kind of setting. But then there are utopian ones also where they escape to some wonderful place or also just visions of the future where we're still right here in place, but it's over.
Yeah. You give advice for people who are traumatized by these dreams. I mean, some of them are, you know, very painful. I'm at a parade and it's a wonderful parade and we're all having fun, but doctors and paramedics keep coming through and carrying away dead bodies. Talk a little bit about how you can maybe control these dreams, like even before you go to sleep.
The just stop anxiety dreams technique is incredibly simple. Basically, you just want to think of what you would like to be dreaming about, whether it's a favorite person you can't see right now, who you'd like to visit with in your dreams, or a perfect place. You pick out what your ideal dream would be, and then as you're falling asleep, you're telling yourself, I want to dream about this. Also form a mental image. Our dreaming mind is so visual. It's also a good way to get that request through to your dreaming mind. It doesn't work perfectly for everyone, but in one study, I found 50% of college students who were focusing on dreaming on a particular topic had a dream about it.
Is that the same as incubating a dream?
Yes, although dream incubation can be used for lots of purposes to change nightmares, not just as in don't have as many, but have some mastery outcome, script a different ending to them. Dream incubation can be used to try to solve a particular problem, whether it's a personal one or, you know, some professional. You're working on a chemistry problem and ask your dream why you're stuck on this and what you need to do differently.
Yeah. You write down the problem as a brief phrase, place it by the bed, review it just before you go to bed, tell yourself you want to dream about the problem just as you're drifting off, and then keep a pen and paper to note as you wake up so you can write it down. I mean, we know that it's kind of in a way good for you because you're having this stress anyway, so you're working it out through your sleep. But that doesn't help, you know, when your heart is pounding and you're I had a dream that I had COVID-19. This is one of the terrible nightmares that I had. I couldn't breathe, and I really couldn't breathe in my dream, and I woke up and both my cats were on my chest. Which is why I couldn't breathe.
Yeah, I noticed that with a lot of dreams that people would describe that the cover was over their face. But yeah, I mean, I really believe in interpreting dreams, but I just hear from so many people, I just want to stop having as many anxiety dreams. They're disturbing mm-hmm. my sleep. They're interfering. And so that's why I've got that. Okay. If you don't want to interpret it, you know, just think of what you want to dream about, and that will make it much less likely that you have anxiety dreams tonight.
What's the arc of dreams?
Yeah, the arc has sort of been from early pandemic, I'm dreaming I've got the virus, and also lots of dreams that seem to be practicing social distance and masks. I get out in public and I suddenly remember I don't have my mask or I'm too close to someone. And then it transitioned while we were still locked down. So people who were locked down alone tended to dreams of being thrown in prison, solitary confinement, dreams of being a one-person Mars colony, people who were sheltering with their whole families and groups of roommates were dreaming that the entire neighborhood had moved into one woman's house and she couldn't even walk through a room because there were so many cots set up with people sleeping on them. Another was trying to go to the bathroom and couldn't close the door because everybody's stuff was blocking the door. That was there in the middle. And then anxiety dreams about the end of the lockdown, especially people who seem to be being called back to work before they're very comfortable with that. Mm. But also more of these long-term visions of the future, which are divided from post-apocalyptic to really utopian ones. My favorite was this woman came outside for the first time and the whales had learned to fly, was her phrase, and whales were swooping through the sky.
Give us another technique here. We know, by the way, you recommend doing this work sometimes with a therapist, but you can do a dream interview.
Yeah, that's about the simplest technique. You can do it with a friend doing the interviewing or interview yourself. You pick out the elements in the dream that just seem like the key parts of it, the main characters, any object that stands out. So you run through each of these key elements and you ask the dreamer or you ask yourself, if you've dreamed about a cat, what is a cat? And one person will say, oh, they're these cute little animals that we have to take care of. They're like our children. And the next person will say, they're animals with sharp teeth. I got bit by a cat when I was a kid and I still have a scar. So you go through each element and then you tie it together, sort of what in my waking life is like, and you kind of string the associations to each of these elements together. This guy, Andy, had dreamed he went into a bar that looked really happy and lively and ordered a drink. And as he was waiting, the man next to him fell over and blew away. He looked at everyone else to see if they were as startled, and he realized they were all cardboard cut out figures and they begin to blow away. So when I was doing the dream interview with him and asked him what cardboard cutouts are, he said, well, the only ones he could really think of were in the movie Home Alone 2, where the little boy is all by himself and criminals are outside wanting to kidnap or murder him. And so he sets up all these life-size cutouts in the windows to look like he's happy and having a big party and lots of friends are there. And so he just immediately heard that as a perfect metaphor. He was locked down alone and, you know, doing Zoom and stuff to kind of create the feeling of having an active social life. And it felt a little two-dimensional to him. And he really, you know, it was not until he was saying cardboard cutouts equal Home Alone that hit him.
Well, it's fascinating. Deirdre Barrett, author, psychologist who teaches at Harvard Medical School, her latest book, Pandemic Dreams. Deirdre, Dr. Barrett, thank you so much.
It was fun to be here.
As House races across the country heat up, we're looking at them each week on Here and Now. And for this week's district profile, we turn to New Mexico's second congressional district. Democratic Congresswoman Xochitl Torres-Small faces a challenge from former state representative Republican Yvette Harrell. It's a rematch from 2018. Joining us now is Joe Monahan, who writes the blog New Mexico Politics with Joe Monahan. Joe, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and Torres-Small is only the second Democrat to represent this district in decades. Can you tell us more, first of all, just about the district?
The district is huge. It's one of the largest congressional districts in America, and it extends basically completely south and west and east from Albuquerque, which is basically in the center of the state. It's largely rural district, except for Doña Ana County, which has the city of Las Cruces, which is the center of progressive politics in the district and where Torres-Small comes from. But the rest of the district leans conservative and often Republican, so it makes for a very interesting matchup.
Well, and let's start with the incumbent, Torres-Small. Here is a recent ad from her campaign.
Water is life. It's the New Mexico way. I'm Xochitl Torres-Small. I've spent my career working with New Mexico farmers and ranchers, protecting water and the water rights they depend on, like federal drought legislation and funding for new conservation methods.
Okay, so she is playing up the environmental points in that ad, but there are ads coming in from outside groups against her, including the Conservative American Action Network, which says that she voted to impeach the president, hasn't fixed the opioid crisis or secured the border. Give us a sense of her candidacy.
I think that that spot kind of sums it up. That spot is about water, which is about as non-controversial, really, as you can get, at least the way she phrases it. This is really going to be a race where the Republicans are going to try to get those hot button issues you mentioned to the front. If Trump cannot perform well in the Southern District, the odds will favor the Torres-Small reelection. Harrell is dependent upon how the president does and is campaigning very closely to him. She knows her fortunes are directly tied to Trump's, and basically that's the race in a nutshell.
Well, and let's listen to one of her ads. This is Yvette Harrell, the Republican.
I'm a Christian conservative, and I'm a Trump conservative. I'm running for Congress, and I'm running for you. I'm Yvette Harrell, and like President Trump, I fought for New Mexico businesses and families against government overreach.
We got to drain the swamp.
That's why I'm endorsed by Trump allies like Mark Meadows, Mike Huckabee, Jim Jordan, and the NRA. I'm asking.
Okay, so she is embracing the far right there in that ad, and it sounds like that's what she's doing in her campaign.
Well, there's nothing complicated about that, is there? She's tied to the hip of the president, and she just puts it all out there. It's a direct plea to the Trump-based voters to get out and vote. It's all about turnout, especially in the southeastern part of the district, which is conservative and which has the big oil and gas industry there. And that's what the race comes down to. Who can get that vote out? Now, Torres-Small got her progressive base out in Las Cruces in a big way 2 years ago, narrowly won the race by less than 3,000 votes. And it looks like we're headed for another barn burner, because the messages from both are going to be very well done. This is a national campaign drawing the top political strategists from across the nation. So this race probably starts as a toss-up or maybe a little bit lean Democrat, because Torres-Small, after all, is the incumbent.
Well, but if Torres-Small is trying to turn out the progressive base that she has, why is she talking about water?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because the progressive base is turning the other way on some of her votes, which have been towards the conservative, or what she likes to call the moderate side, in order to appease the conservatives and not get them all out of their seats to vote against her. So it's interesting. She did not receive a primary from a progressive, but her voting record does skirt the progressives on several matters, including stuff like gun control. There's also a proposal to put high-level nuclear waste storage sites in that district, and she has not come out against it like the rest of the congressional delegation. You know, so she has skirted a few of the issues also, like Medicare for All, the Green New Deal, that are dear to the progressive hearts. But they so want to get rid of Trump, and they so want to have a Democrat, that I think that she's been given a pass on some of those more controversial items that she's voted on vis-a-vis the progressive base.
I imagine there are not a lot of polls going on in the second district of New Mexico.
No, but I think that we both can ascertain from these radio spots and the fundraising that's going to come in that this race is going to be highly competitive. Again, a lot of it's going to depend on how the president performs. He won this district by 10 points in 2016. If he falls below that level, you would have to say that the prospects of Torres Small are improved. But if he holds at that level or more, there may not be much that Torres Small could do to avoid a Harris win.
That is Joe Monahan, who writes the blog New Mexico Politics with Joe Monahan, joining us from Albuquerque to talk about the second district in New Mexico and the race there. Joe, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And I should say, Robin, all this talk about New Mexico, full disclosure, I have been binging Breaking Bad. I'd never seen it before. And I just finished season 4 last night, so only one left.
Beware of mild-mannered chemistry teachers.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It is Here and Now.